Welcome, everyone. We are here at the IANS conference in Westminster, Colorado. And for those of you who are first listeners, that is the International Association for Near-Death Studies. And this, of course, is Marcy Newman, host of HeartShift Radio. And I have the privilege, the honor, and I have to say the sheer delight of having Dr. Eben Alexander with me here today, who has an incredible story on so many levels. And I know that you are going to be stuck to your seats for the moments to come, because it is astounding, but it's also so heartfelt and open-hearted. And I think that that is so much of the message that you're going to hear. So welcome, Eben. I'm so happy to have you here. Thank you so much.
Marcy, thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
So a little bit about your background. Now, you are a neurosurgeon. Correct. And have been in practice for how many years?
I finished med school in 1980, 7-year residency, and then close to 25 years in practice after that.
And so during those 25 years of dedicating your life to conventional medicine, would you have ever expected to be here speaking to me at a conference about near-death studies and the exploration of consciousness?
Well, I think the exploration of consciousness might not be such a surprise.
Okay.
But having the kind of grand view of it that I have now is something I really could not have foreseen before my coma, because I really subscribe to the conventional neuroscientific worldview, which is based in physicalism, the notion that only the physical world exists. And that thinking implies that, of course, the physical brain must somehow be creating consciousness out of purely physical matter. And of course, there are many problems with that view. For one thing, neuroscience has never made one step at all in a direction of showing how the physical brain might create consciousness. And that was kind of the revolution that I was facing in my own thinking, which came through my NDE. But I've also come to realize in the 9 years since my NDE is a pathway that all of the modern scientific world is on in trying to understand the relationship between brain and mind. And I believe it's leading to one of the most profound revolutions in all of human thought.
So also for our first-time listeners, just to clarify, NDE stands for near-death experience. So you've alluded to this, that you've actually experienced that. Would you mind giving our audience a synopsis of what happened to you? What brought you to this pivotal place? It's what I call the heart shift. Mm-hmm. It's where our heart actually shifts, and from my perspective, it's vibrational frequency and opens us up into a whole new world mm-hmm. of shift in perspective, shift in our own consciousness, and how we live in the world. So
I think it's important to start by saying that the disease that I had, this very severe and aggressive gram-negative bacterial meningitis, is one that was so severe, as my physicians knew from my neurologic exams, from my scans, from my lab values, that I should have had absolutely no conscious experience at all. All 8 lobes of my neocortex were under attack from this very aggressive bacterial meningitis. And that, of course, was the shock, although it took me weeks and even months after my coma to really appreciate just how ill I had been and how impossible any kind of experience was. And that's why the experience I had was so amazing, is because it completely violated everything that modern neuroscience would try and teach us about the role of the neocortex in the detailed construction of conscious awareness. Now, my illness began with severe back pain and headache, driven into coma over 3.5 hours, grand mal seizures, my family calling 911, getting the EMTs to the house. But I was already deeply in coma at that point from this progressive meningitis.
So what you're describing, that it happened that quickly?
It happened very rapidly. I had basically no kind of warning of any of this. It started at 4:30 in the morning on November 10th, 2008, and literally within three and a half hours, I was deep in coma and seizing, and the EMTs then hauled me off to the Lynchburg General Hospital emergency room, where I encountered Dr. Laura Potter, and I had worked closely side by side with her for several years there because I'd been a neurosurgeon in that very hospital. She didn't even recognize me at first. All she saw was 54-year-old white male in extremis, status epilepticus, trying to die right there on her watch. She was the one smart enough to do a lumbar puncture. When the needle went into the fluid space in my back, the fluid space that contains the brain and spinal cord, out came thick white pus under pressure. And she told me much later that when she saw that and then got the report back from microbiology that it was a gram-negative bacterial meningitis, she knew I was a goner. Mm-hmm. She put me on three very powerful intravenous antibiotics on a ventilator up on the medical ICU. The next day, they found out it was E. coli, which, if you do a medical literature search, E. coli meningitis almost always occurs in newborns. It's very rare beyond the age of 3 months. So my doctors had that little mystery of how in the world had I acquired this very strange disease. They estimated when I first got in the emergency room that I had a 10% chance of survival. By the end of that week, that estimate was down to a 2% chance of survival. And the problem was, if I was in that 2% category, all that my doctors could foresee was that I would spend the rest of my life in a nursing home in a persistent vegetative state, unresponsive, where I would finally succumb. And that's why on the seventh day of the coma, when they held a family conference, their recommendation was to stop the antibiotics and let nature take its course. And it was soon after that that I started coming back to this world. And when I did come back, the interesting thing is that my words, language, all my personal memories of Evan Alexander's life, all my scientific knowledge, all my religious beliefs, every bit of it was completely gone, had been deleted through the entire experience. Deep in coma, I had no memories whatsoever of Evan Alexander's life, and without any earthly words or language, all of it was just a pure experience without any kind of prior history, and that's what gave me an empty slate for such a robust journey of discovery, and I think that was all part of my own personal journey. NDEs always have kind of a personal flavor. They happen to an individual soul that's on its own soul journey, but the remarkable thing are the similarities. And when you study hundreds and thousands of NDEs over all millennia, from all continents, all belief systems, what you end up discovering is there are surprising commonalities that prove these are about a very real realm. In fact, a realm that most NDEers would describe as much more real than this world. So in my particular case, what that involved was my deep NDE experience beginning in the earthworm's eye view, primitive, coarse, unresponsive. It was like being in dirty jello. I have a strong memory of roots or blood vessels all around me. But then I was rescued by this slowly spinning clear white light. I called it the spinning melody because it came packaged with beautiful music. And as that light came towards me, slowly spinning with fine silvery and golden tendrils off of it, it opened up like a rip in the fabric of that ugly earthworm eye view realm up into this brilliant ultra-real gateway valley that was filled with earth-like features like lots of plant life, blossoms, buds, flowers blooming and blossoming all around me, very dynamic, no signs of any death or decay. I was a speck of awareness on a butterfly wing with millions of other butterflies spiraling in these vast formations, and beside me on the butterfly wing was this beautiful girl who was, in fact, I came to see her as my guardian angel, who gave me what I think is the most central message of my whole journey. You are deeply loved and cherished forever. You have nothing to fear. You will be taken care of. And to me, that was such a refreshing message. Now, it did not come verbally delivered as words. It came as pure conceptual flow, emotional power to it. And I only used those words later in trying to record the way those thoughts came into my mind and awareness. But remember that through this entire journey, I was nonverbal. There were no words. There was no bottleneck of our linguistic kind of flow of communication, but much more robust communication is often happens in that realm. That's why it's often so difficult to put into any words. But in this beautiful Gateway Valley, there were thousands of souls down below us dancing in this meadow, lots of joy and merriment. It was all being fueled because up above were these swooping golden orbs of light, leaving sparkling golden trails against a blue-black velvet sky.
It sounds so beautiful.
It was absolutely indescribable, and the words are miserably poor at trying to convey the reality of it.
Ineffable.
It was so much more than that. That's right. People often use that word ineffable, indescribable. But the good news is we can all come to know that realm. That's why I'm such a proponent of meditation, of centering prayer, of going within, because this emerging model of consciousness reveals that if consciousness is not created by the physical brain, but is primordial in the universe, then when we go deep into consciousness in prayer and meditation or through a spiritually transformative experience like a near-death experience, we are getting in touch with that universal mind and broadening our connection to it. But again, that's why the experiences there can be so hard to describe, because the bandwidth of that kind of interaction and that kind of knowing is far greater than what we're used to living these little human lives. Now, on this journey deep in coma, that Gateway Valley was only a stepping stone. And I remember seeing all of space and time collapsing down in the lower material realms in four-dimensional space-time. And then even causality, what I call deep time relationships, in that Gateway Valley realm, which is the same realm where we would encounter souls of departed loved ones, go through our life review, encounter that infinite healing love of the divine creative source of the universe, and then make plans to re-enter, to reincarnate and come back to get it better and better with each progressive incarnation in our pathway of ascendance towards oneness with the divine. But that was a stepping stone on my journey, because I went beyond that to what I call the core. And the vehicle for that ascendance was the angelic choir. Sound, vibration, frequency has always provided a traversal mechanism for our souls to traverse those realms.
And the basis of creation.
And the basis of creation. And of course, we've used music. For example, the didgeridoo is allegedly a 40,000-year-old healing musical instrument. Very healing tones, very powerful. And yet all of this interest in music vibration in the acoustics of ancient tombs and of cathedrals has been to use music to help us to get into transcendental states of conscious awareness. And of course, that's where the beautiful gift from my journey has to do with a lot of my current work with my partner, Karen Newell, who is co-author of my third book coming out October 2017. That's entitled Living in a Mindful Universe. And there we help people get tools that are very useful in going deep within consciousness of traversing this veil that separates us from that universal mind. And that is something that as a conscious sentient being, any of us have the power to do by going within.
So you brought up the concept of the veil. So from your perspective, this newfound perspective that obviously has evolved even from your experience, would you say that the veil actually exists, or is it because of our limited perception that we perceive that there is separation?
I would say the veil is very intentional.
Okay.
We come into this world planning with our higher soul and soul group and in the presence of that divine, infinite healing power of love, we come into this world planning the hardships and difficulties.
Mm-hmm.
People may have difficulty accepting that, but it starts to make more sense, especially when you look back on your life and see how often those darkest moments, the dark night of the soul, is a beautiful engine of growth.
Yes.
That those hardships and difficulties, whether they be illness or injury or loss or what have you, they are what allow our souls to grow. So the veil is very intentional that prevents us from remembering past lives and between lives. We're not supposed to have all the knowledge of the higher soul. Now, important to point out that that higher soul does not have infinite knowledge. People often will say that around NDEs, and I would say that maybe the knowledge appears infinite from a certain perspective, but that in fact that higher soul is involved in this beautiful growth process of really I would say the evolution of all of consciousness, kind of along the lines
participating.
Of, right, participating. Mm-hmm. Along the lines of Teilhard de Chardin, The Phenomenon of Man, his beautiful mid-20th century book, that basically portrayed a much grander role of a conscience, of evolution, far beyond the simplistic kind of misinterpretation of Darwinian evolution, where people focus on survival of the fittest and kind of a chaotic mechanistic process that seems to be purposeless and meaningless. But in fact, there is an evolution going on, but it's a far grander evolution filled with meaning and purpose for the whole reason for existence of this universe. Is that evolution of consciousness. And that is nothing more, just like the old saying that all politics is local. Likewise, the evolution of all consciousness on the grand cosmological scale is nothing more than the growth of individual sentient beings participating in this dance of reincarnation and ascendance towards oneness with the divine, that we are all in that process and participating in that evolution of consciousness itself.
So what you're describing is actually what we're witnessing is because of the evolution of the consciousness of all of creation, that we're stepping into this opportunity of being conscious participants as opposed to being in that mode of sheer survival,
right,
which our ancestors and predecessors were sort of stuck in that dog chasing its tail,
right,
kind of existence. And that perhaps where we are today is, number one, as I said, evidence of this incredible expansiveness of consciousness. But the fact that we can consciously participate in our right. own expansion and know that we are making these incredible deposits into right. the whole is a whole new world
it
of
is.
Opportunity and recognition of our potential and also our purpose. You use that word, our
right.
purpose, stepping into that. And that's what I think is so phenomenal. And you so beautifully articulated that we can actually be consciously present. And I think that that's what we're doing here at IANS, wouldn't you say?
I would say that is very much the case. I mean, all of what you're saying aligns beautifully with what is going on in scientific and philosophical circles around the mind-body question. Because, in fact, every bit of this discussion is nothing more than an assessment of the mind-body relationship. And this is something that Karen and I go into in great detail in Living in a Mindful Universe, because it's important to realize kind of the fundament of this discussion. And that is looking at the mind-body, the spectrum of possibilities anchored at one pole with pure materialism, the conventional scientific view that the physical world is all that exists, that somehow the brain must create consciousness. But one of the problems there, of course, is that there's no allowance for free will. That view, materialist brain creates consciousness, simply says that consciousness is an illusion of the chemical reactions in the brain. They're all following natural laws of physics and chemistry, and so obviously consciousness and free will itself are complete illusions. They have no reality at all. And to me, that's the exact opposite of the reality
that
I've come to realize through my NDE. But that's the materialist position, brain creates consciousness, that also says that our existence is birth to death and nothing more. Now then you have the whole spectrum of dualities, of various relationships between mind and brain, that where you can never completely reduce one to the other, except at the two opposite poles, but that they have some kind of interaction with each other. But I would say that all those dualistic positions are merely stepping stones, that the true answer is going to lie at one pole or the other, either scientific
Important
or materialism.
Stepping stones.
Right. Important, but they are stepping stones nonetheless.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other pole, though, is where the interest should lie. The opposite pole is that of metaphysical or ontological idealism, which is the view that consciousness is fundamental in the universe. It's the thing that exists and creates all of reality out of itself. So consciousness is primordial, pre-existed the Big Bang. And this, of course, is the view that many fathers of quantum physics were trying to steer us towards. If you look at the words of Werner Heisenberg, Erwin Schrödinger, Paul Dirac, Louis de Broglie, Sir James Jeans, and others, quantum physicists who were telling us you cannot get behind consciousness. It is fundamental in the universe. The scientific community at large has had great trouble going there. And I would say the reason for that is largely because in the 400-year history of the scientific revolution, they started all that in the days of Galileo and Isaac Newton and Francis Bacon and Giordano Bruno and others, trying to investigate the laws of the natural world and trying to pretend that we're separate, that man and his mind, observational powers of the mind, are separate from that world they're observing. Of course, if they got too close to mind and consciousness, they were likely to get burned at the stake by the all-more-powerful church, as Bruno indeed was.
Like too close to the sun.
Exactly, like Icarus, flying way too close to the sun. But so that was kind of the built into the DNA of the scientific revolution, is you study the material world, it's separate from human beings and human minds, and that's all there is to it. Now enter the 20th century and the advent of quantum physics, and all of a sudden that Newtonian kind of causality deterministic universe was greatly jeopardized. And in fact, quantum physics contributes greatly to this deeper understanding because it addresses very directly the mind and brain connection about our knowledge of the universe and the physical world. And so, in fact, when you really take that broad objective view of what quantum physics is trying to teach us, and this is something that was very clear to some of those early investigators and founding fathers, very brilliant physicists, is you have to put mind in fundamental position. And that's where I would say, well, all of those dualities are really just stepping stones in our thinking. But to really make progress, you have to go to metaphysical or ontological idealism, where mind is indeed primordial and creates all of it. And part of that understanding, as we portray in our book, Living in a Mindful Universe, is an acknowledgement of what I call, Karen and I call, the supreme illusion. And that is actually not even a debatable point. And that is simply that what we experience, you know, sitting in this room and looking around and seeing the walls, seeing you here, looking out, seeing other people in the lobby, trees and lakes outdoors, the clouds in the sky at night, the beautiful stars and galaxies, what I'm experiencing is my own internal model of that, built within consciousness, deep in my mind, that the mind and brain trick us into believing is out there.
So it's a projection.
It's a projection.
Subjective projection.
And this is very, very crucial. And we make this point by elaborating on the kind of value of subjective over objective knowledge. And we talk about that extensively in Living in a Mindful Universe. But it's crucial to get that and to realize that it's always been an internal construct, that we've never known anything other than the inside of our own consciousness. So it's time to move beyond the supreme illusion and start investigating that consciousness. And that's why it's so powerful to go within. And that's why Karen and I do these workshops around the world using sacred acoustics. And for your listeners who are interested in learning more, I would advise you to go to sacredacoustics.com. Mm-hmm. She has a free 20-minute OM download. Yeah. That you can get started with, listen through headphones. Because what we're using are differential sound frequencies. That is a very slight difference in the frequencies presented to the two ears. So when you listen through headphones, they have the most impact, even though they've been designed by Sacred Acoustics to also work quite well through speakers. And that's why we can do these workshops. But this is a very powerful tool to enable you to develop your observer self. Because whether you're talking about the great difficulty and challenge to neuroscience, so what's called the hard problem of consciousness, which is the impossible problem of consciousness if you're trying to somehow use the physical brain to explain phenomenal conscious experience, and also the measurement paradox in quantum physics. Both of those, which are some of the deepest mysteries in modern scientific thought, hit an impasse because of the fact that they are getting to the observer, to the awareness, the self-awareness of the universe. And it turns out that in meditation, you can come to realize that you are not your thoughts. You are not that little voice in your head. That is the voice of your ego. The ego has two tools.
Great point.
Yeah, the ego uses fear and anxiety. Mm-hmm. And your thoughts, separation. That living, running, and a false sense of separation mm-hmm. from the universe. That's where quantum physics is very important, because it really shows us that we are all one with that universe. There right. is no separation. And this is a crucial thing. The boundaries of self are very artificial. And by going into mind, going into consciousness, in deep meditation, we can come to identify with that one mind. And that is extremely powerful. Developing the observer self, coming to realize that the thoughts that are there, that little voice in our head. Michael Singer, in his book, The Untethered Soul, refers to that voice in the head as the annoying roommate.
Yes.
I love that.
I love
absolutely.
That, too. I've read that.
Don't get caught in the trap mm-hmm. of thinking that that little linguistic brain, which, of course, is how we communicate in scientific and philosophical thought. So it's important for human communication, but it is not the be-all and end-all of our potential for discovery. And that's why going within has such tremendous power, and why you don't have to have an NDE to come to know every bit of this. Through meditation alone, I promise you, you can come to know fully everything I know and much more about the reality of that spiritual realm that is the basis of our very existence. That is our true home in many ways.
Our core nature.
And yet I would say the entire universe exists for this world,
yes.
for this material world that we live in, because our souls are chomping at the bit to get down into these bodies and live these lives, knowing full well that they have to be dumbed down,
yes.
that that veil has to be in place. There's a programmed forgetting. And that is what enables this to be soul school. That's what enables us to have the emotional power and buy-in to these lives that we live, and to learn those lessons of love, compassion, forgiveness, acceptance, and mercy that we are here to learn now, and have been challenged to learn as a species for the last many thousands of years. And we are finally getting to a point where we are beginning to assimilate that lesson of the prophets delivered so long ago. And believe it or not, one of the interesting things, it's just the science that is leading us there, the science of quantum physics, that actually forces us to realize that this is a spiritual universe, that there is one mind, that the brain doesn't produce consciousness at all, but is simply that reducing valve or filter that allows primordial consciousness in. And that when we die, or when we have spiritually transformative experiences, we come into much broader contact with that infinite loving force of healing. And that is what many describe as God.
Yes.
But it doesn't matter if you've got the word God or Allah, Brahman, Vishnu, Jehovah, Yahweh, love, great spirit. Mm-hmm. I don't care what the word is.
Right.
The words get in the way. In fact, the orthodox, the religious teachings that try to preach separation are all greatly in error, because the original message of the prophets is all around oneness and love and compassion and mercy, that we're all in this together, not just humans, but all of life on earth. And not only that, all of sentience throughout the cosmos. And this is one of the deepest lessons that I think humanity is here to learn today from all of this awakening that is typified by groups like IONS and the near-death experiencers and others who are helping to educate this world about the nature of reality. And those scientists who study brain and mind, and these extraordinary human experiences, which are such powerful pieces of evidence leading us in the right direction.
So we need to back up for a second, because you used the term free will. And what keeps coming up as you're speaking is the suggestion that you have that our choice is what activates all of this. So you speak about meditation. You speak about our potentiality. You speak about this cosmos that we have the capability of tapping into, tuning into. But it seems to me that what you're saying is that everything is activated by choice.
Well, I would say choice, interesting.
Free will,
interesting
the fact
comparison.
That we have this.
Interesting comparison is to look at that materialist worldview that I mentioned before, mm-hmm. that I spent the first 54 years of my life developing. And it's kind of the conventional view now, although it won't be for long, and that is that, of course, brain creates consciousness, and that we can have no free will because it's all just chemical reactions
right.
going on in the brain. Now, I know through my own personal experience and through the experience of many thousands of others, through the scientific studies of the mind-body connection, that view is absolutely false. In fact, I would say that the world exists entirely for sentient beings to manifest their free will, to make these choices of discovery. Now, it turns out that the quantum physics is important because what quantum physics teaches us very clearly is that there is this cloud of possibilities of outcome, of choices of this universe that are there, but there is the choice made by the observer about how to observe this world and certain choices that we put in that then have a response from nature. This is something that was well worked out by John von Neumann, one of the most brilliant mathematicians who ever lived, who formulated quantum physics and came up with certain processes that were involved. But choice and will of the observer was very crucial in determining how nature would respond to that choice and then evolve. If you look at the works of Carl Friedrich von Weizsäcker or John Wheeler, John Wheeler, a renowned Princeton physicist who gave us things like the black hole and wormhole in terms of concepts in the public mind. Towards the end of his life, he was very interested in the role of consciousness. And of course, as most quantum physicists, he realized that consciousness was a very deep mystery and that you could not simply explain this world based on the physical workings alone, but you had to go deep and try and come to a more facile understanding of consciousness and mind and what they really are. And he came up with this notion of the participatory anthropic universe. And his notion was basically that all of evolving reality depends on the observing mind, that we are all participants in the creation of the co-creators, exactly, of the universe that's coming into existence at all times. And I think that kind of thinking kind of gets lost in some of the math and physics of quantum mechanics. For example, in trying to interpret the measurement paradox, which is really the very deep mystery of that observing mind and its role in precipitating out emergent reality, in that whole kind of discussion and looking at that, it turns out that quantum physics implies that the mind is the selector that ends up bringing one of all of those many infinite potentialities of subatomic measurements into reality. Now, the thing that people have to remember about all this is, again, going back to that supreme illusion, that modern neuroscience would tell you that every bit of what I'm perceiving about the world around me is nothing more than neurotransmitters and ion channel activity within the brain that is then bringing into conscious awareness some notion of a world out there. But remember that every bit of that perceptual apparatus consists of small particles, ions, and neurotransmitters confined to very tight channels. So they're basically using the Heisenberg uncertainty principle by having a tight confinement within space that then greatly extends the spectrum of potentiality of momentum. And that's where the action is. That is where consciousness can actually influence the physical world through the brain and give us this picture of physical world that emerges in that mental model. But in fact, it's always just a mental model. And quantum physics is the link to understanding how all the worlds of possibilities and potentialities and choices of the mind of the observer come into reality. But it's all occurring at that subatomic or at that atomic and molecular level of tight confinement within space that greatly opens the channel of possibilities for momentum. And that is what then results in the reality that we perceive.
But we can also understand then how easily anything that conventional science is trying to put through the filter of the scientific method just falls apart because of this phenomenon that we're now really, I think, grasping as reality, that you can never put anything of this nature through that filter and expect the consistency that one would want to make a determination from. In other words, because what you're saying is that the influence that we have on any subject, right, from that quantum physics perspective, changes everything.
Well, it does. It has an influence on it, very much the case. I mean, a beautiful positive example is the placebo effect.
Yes.
Where people believe.
Great example.
People believe that they're mm-hmm. taking a medication, or maybe they had a surgical procedure or a sham surgical procedure that should make them better. And beginning in the 1950s, with the recognition of placebo effect, it became the greatest enemy of big pharma, because the placebo effect is so powerful.
Yes.
That in many kind of conditions and situations and symptomatologies, they came to realize that roughly 30% or so of the benefit can just be mind over matter. And of course, they looked at that as the glass half empty. Why not turn it around and look at the glass half full, and the fact that people can use their minds to greatly influence their health?
And we see that everywhere.
This is the revolution coming to our world today in terms of healthcare, is coming to realize as healers and practitioners, and also as individual patients in charge of our own health, is that all healing, whether you're talking about physical, mental, emotional health, every bit of it is based fundamentally in spiritual health. And when I say that, I'm using spiritual in the context.
I agree 100%.
Using spiritual in the context of just a sense of connectedness.
Yes.
With the universe, that we're connected to the divine, that our higher soul has tremendous power. And we come to realize that our beliefs play a gigantic role in everything about our understanding of the nature of reality. But what I would point out is that our culture at large, in general, the effect of those beliefs is very limiting, confining, constricting, whereas in fact, more open beliefs about our potentialities and possibilities opens the door wide to very real potential for the human spirit to greatly control the emergence of the reality we dream. And this is where I think it's so important to kind of get this new emerging scientific model of the brain and mind and their connection, that the brain is simply a reducing valve or filter that limits primordial consciousness down to this tiny little trickle of the apparent here and now. And as we come to realize that not only through NDEs and other spiritually transformative experiences, we have the power to traverse that veil, whether it be through centering prayer or deep meditation. And again, for those who don't feel they can meditate, I would recommend trying differential sound frequency brain entrainment of sacred acoustics. But these are all very powerful tools to traverse that veil, get more in touch with that universal mind. It turns out that there are great inventors, scientists, artists, musicians, for example, Albert Einstein, Thomas Alva Edison, one of the greatest inventors of the 20th century, Salvador Dali, a great painter, Robert Louis Stevenson, a beautiful writer, novelist, musician, they all wrote about how their inspirations and creativity came from the universe. They didn't think their way to these things at all. They would daydream. They'd get into a hypnagogic state. They had various means of just letting their mind wander, of daydreaming. As Einstein said, knowledge is nothing. Imagination is everything. And so, in fact, all of us can tap into that. And the ultimate source of creativity is that universal mind. And through going within, through meditation, centering prayer, each and every one of us has the power to engage that infinite cosmic mind, of which our very conscious awareness is a direct extension. And by doing that, coming to realize that the perceived limitations are just that. They're perceived, but they're not real.
That's
and
right.
Our beliefs then can open the door wide to the potentialities that I believe at this time we cannot even imagine how grand they truly are. But I believe that this is the real value of the awakening coming to modern science around the mind-body question, as we open up more into an understanding of consciousness and how primordial consciousness shapes this entire world. We will come to far greater human potential. And not only that, of course, the world will become a far more harmonious, peaceful, loving place.
Absolutely. I want to ask you a question. Evan, what do you think the impact of a person's ability to love themselves has on the choices that they make, the free will that they extend out?
I would say that, in fact, coming back from my coma in those first few weeks and trying to put it all together, I came to realize that by far the greatest reason for all the kind of troubles and travesty in this world is the fact that we don't love ourselves enough.
Thank you.
By that, I mean we don't remember that we are sacred, divine, eternal beings, one with God. We have to recover that memory. And that is a crucial part of this. I used to think, you know, before my coma, the tough part was loving the neighbor, loving the enemy. And in fact, really, the vast majority of the world's problems are we don't love ourselves enough. We don't remember that we're divinely connected, that we are perfectly deserving of the infinite healing power of love. And it's recovering that connection with the universe, that sense of oneness, and that there we are therefore connected with all other life. So that ancient lesson from religions, you know, do unto others as you would have done unto yourself, is identical with this one mind concept emerging in modern neuroscience and philosophy of mind. By hurting another, I am only hurting myself. You don't have to go any farther than looking at the life review, commonly described in near-death experiences.
Right.
Life reviews occur in anywhere from 30 to 50% of the millions and millions of NDEs that are reported out there. And the life review involves witnessing those events in your life where you still have residual baggage that must be resolved, interactions with others, especially of receiving love or giving love, where you failed to do it in this lifetime. But in that life review experience, you experience it from the point of view of others, of those who were affected by your actions and even your thoughts. And that's a crucial distinction because the life review shows very clearly that part of this construct is an artificial sense of self. And that's what allows this dance to occur. Although we're all part of one mind doing this beautiful dream together, this dream of growth, of soul school, of learning and teaching, we're all in it together, and that's why we have that emotional power and buy-in to our existence. But that's also why the veil is there, why we're not privy to the knowledge of that higher soul. But we can come to knowing much better that higher soul, the same one we come in touch with at the time of death during an NDE or a death experience, through meditation, through going within, through developing that observer within, the observer that can realize that your thoughts, that little voice in your head, is not who you are at all. The magic of who you are is that observer. And that's what we can grow, and that observer self can become very neutral in many ways, but also sees the higher good and the win-win of every situation. And it's that that we can develop in meditation. My life partner in all this, Karen Newell, often urges me and others to have a daily review.
Sure.
Why keep all that baggage until the end of your life when you have to go through it all? Why not get through all that in this lifetime? Make those amends, apologize, forgive. One of the greatest benefits of forgiving goes to the forgiver. It frees the forgiver from the shackles of their hatred and their lack of forgiveness. Forgiveness is a beautiful tool. Likewise, gratitude.
That's right.
Gratitude is the greatest of all virtues. And I would say the parent of all virtues, as Cicero said. I'm paraphrasing him. But this is all about gratitude for every moment of this existence. Also, all is well. The concept of knowing that at any moment, all is truly well. If we are able to take the proper perspective, take that observer view, that much higher view of the situation, come to realize that the darkness of every valley of an illness, an injury, of loss, can be matched by the beauty of the light and love up on the ridge if we're willing to learn the lessons.
Right.
That's why the hardships in life are gifts. And it's the gift is through recovering that memory of connection, of love, that this is all meant to be as it is, and coming to have that higher view that sees us all as interconnected, that if we serve to love ourselves by channeling that love of the Creator for the creation and serving as a conduit so that love flows through us out to others in this world, choices of compassion, choosing mercy, acceptance and forgiveness, and above all, that unconditional love for all that is. I mean, this is an ancient lesson. It's nothing new. And I don't think anyone would doubt that if more of us lived from this position, the world would become a far greater place. And that is what I think is happening even now.
I do too. And I think that this conference and the way that this consciousness is expanding within each and every one of us. And it sort of brings us back to the beginning of our conversation about being recognizing that we have this capability of actually being conscious participants, and we do have the capability of just creating a greater world, but of course impacting all of the universes,
right?
Because we are all one.
That is true.
So in closing, I do want to make certain that we talk about the books that you have available to everyone, because they're so powerful. Proof of Heaven, I just think it shattered some paradigms that people never expected it to. I mean, it was just such an incredible offering to the world. And you have Map of Heaven, right? Which
Correct.
Was your second book, and now you have
yes.
a third book coming out in October. I can't recommend enough that I hope that every single one of our listeners runs out and buys those books. And of course, takes the opportunity to participate in your workshops that you're doing with Karen. And is all that information on your website, by the way, where
all
you're
it is,
going to be?
If people go to ebenalexander.com, and that's E-B as in Baker, E-N, alexander.com, all the information is there on that front page. You just click on Living in a Mindful Universe, the cover of the book there, takes you right to a page that has a lot of endorsements for the book, and there are many different people from scientific and spiritual sides who have endorsed this book. They see it as a bridge that really brings spirituality and science together. And I often say that neither science nor spirituality can really move forward without the other.
I agree.
This is about a unification, and Living in a Mindful Universe, A Neurosurgeon's Journey into the Heart of Consciousness, which comes out in October 2017, we believe is a bridge-building book that helps to really align this for the modern intellectual seeker, of those who really want to know more about the nature of our existence, to see where this mind-body question is going, kind of see a glimpse of what the next few decades and centuries will bring in terms of this awakening of humanity. I think Living in a Mindful Universe is a very good resource. I would also encourage those seekers who want to go within and want to learn more about this, because at the end of the day, this is not about armchair philosophy.
No.
And idle curiosity about the nature of reality. So much of this depends on personal experience. And as conscious, sentient beings, we all have that power. And for your listeners who already have a method of going within, quieting that little voice, the little voice in the head, fine. But if you need some help, I would strongly encourage you to visit sacredacoustics.com. That's Karen Newell's website. Karen Newell is my co-author of Living in a Mindful Universe. And Sacred Acoustics has put together some extremely powerful tools using differential frequency brain entrainment to help people break free from the illusion of the here and now, to get into very deep transcendental states of conscious awareness, and to come into touch with much greater guidance, wisdom, connection with souls of departed loved ones, creativity, insight. I mean, the answers lie within us all. And a full practice of meditation. I encourage daily meditation. I try to meditate an hour or two a day, more if I can. But these tools are very powerful. She has a free 20-minute OM download. Listen to that through headphones. She has some instructional videos at sacredacoustics.com that are available for free. They're very helpful at helping people to really reap the benefits of this kind of journey, seeking to go within. Because you never have to approach the end of life wondering what's going to happen when you die. You can come to know it full well through a practice of meditation and centering prayer, and coming to know the answers truly lie within us all.
And be fearless in taking that leap.
Exactly. We have nothing to fear. And that's one of the most beautiful gifts of this.
Yes,
it is. Is to realize that as we come to know our connection to that infinite healing power of ultimate creation in this universe, that unconditional love of the divine creator source, that we have nothing to fear, no matter what we encounter in these spiritual journeys.
And if I may quote you from one of my absolute favorite quotes, none of us gets out of here dead.
That is true. Sorry, if you were banking on that one, you're out of luck.
So why not start now?
Right.
Right.
Of course, important to point out that reincarnation is a critical part of that analysis and understanding.
That's right.
And that is crucial. But of course, the scientific evidence for reincarnation is quite strong.
Yes. So just, if there's any message here, it is to explore, 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 and find the way within.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And know that you are one with the universe, and as a conscious sentient being, we have ways of knowing far more than we do today about the nature of our connection with the universe, and that it is all bound together through that infinite healing power of unconditional love.
Fantastic. Well, thank you so very much. This has been such an enlightening and passionate interview, and that's the one thing that is so incredible about you, your passion, your commitment to spreading the word about the truth and the potential for each and every one of us is so appreciated. So thank you from the bottom of my heart. And as the Heart Shift coach, I also want to encourage everyone to really take in these words, particularly the ones that are speaking to your heart right now. You can feel the reverberation of it. Self-love, forgiveness, gratitude. These are all things that as we embrace, we really do become a greater, more expansive version of ourselves. So again, thank you so much. And
I'm just so very grateful,
Evan. Yeah, it's been fantastic. So again, this is Marcy Newman, your host of HeartShift Radio, and you can find this and, of course, so many other podcasts at www.heartshiftcoach.com. Many blessings and great love to you, and have fun.